This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Gholam was just an 11-year-old boy when the United States invaded Afghanistan in late 2001. With the Taliban out, for the first time in his life, Gholam went to a school where he learned English. A decade later, he put those language skills to use and became an interpreter for the United States Air Force.
The reason I went to work as an interpreter first, I needed to find money to feed my family. The second was helping American because we had to work with them to build our country, shoulder to shoulder.
He worked shoulder to shoulder with Americans like Michael Tritt. Mike had served in the U.S. Air Force from 2002 to 2008, four deployments to Iraq. When he was a civilian, Mike went to work for a private contractor. That sent him to Afghanistan in 2012, where he and Gholam standardized airplane manuals for the Afghan Air Force. They quickly became friends.
I could actually talk to him about things, philosophy stuff, religion. You know, I can ask him questions about the Quran. I can, you know, we can talk about Christianity. And it was just refreshing because you can't even have those conversations in our country right now. He's actually a poet in disguise. He'll bring up obscure poetry from like the 13th century, knows most of it in his head. And he'll like, oh, go look this up. And this poet, he'll have answers for you.
Gholam is just one of tens of thousands of Afghan interpreters who worked with the U.S. government over the span of 20 years. In that time, Mike returned to the United States. Gholam got married and had two children. In 2009, the U.S. government promised Afghan interpreters visas to the U.S. in case the Taliban retaliated or returned to power. Well, that return to power happened last year. With the announcement of a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban swiftly took city after city. Gholam realized he needed to get serious about trying to get a visa to the U.S. So he messaged Mike. Mike emailed the National Visa Center, but fell short. So Gholam went into hiding.
I was hiding into different places as I figured out if the Taliban are getting close to the city, then the first thing they would do is just detain and behead and or killing the people who worked with Americans.
It was only a matter of time till they found his name at the base and his picture. So I'm like, you just need to burn everything, but it's still not going to be enough.
Mid-August, the Taliban captured Herat, Gholam's home city. Now, Mike wasn't the only U.S. vet watching what was happening in Afghanistan. So he reached out to a friend who was in touch with many other people who had worked in or been deployed to Afghanistan. They felt compelled to do whatever they could to help evacuate as many Afghan interpreters and other workers out of the country. And they called their mission Operation North Star. Mike and other Operation North Star colleagues determined that for Gholam and his family to get out of Afghanistan, they first needed to get on a bus from Herat to Kabul.
On the way, it was very frightening. It was very scary. Taliban were everywhere. I passed like maybe close, maybe more than 50 checkpoints. It was a really scary 24 hours. I got some bandages and I just put them on my head, on my hand. And anytime they were coming to the bus and stopping the bus and asking and looking, I was just showing them I'm a sick guy and I'm about to die.
Gholam and his family reached Kabul. Mike told them to get to the airport and try to get on any airplane they could. Mike was at home in Arizona, sending Gholam intel on which gates to try.
My VFW commander happened to be former NSA, and he was feeding me some intel. I had a guy that was working some of the drones showed up, and then he was feeding me what intel he legally could on what gates had less people at it. So we were trying to make runs for certain gates.
They tried for days. Mike received the intel. He texted Gholam, and Gholam would make a run for the airport. Once, Mike got a tip and sent Gholam to a gate with some Marine guards.
And the minute I sent him to that gate, get a flash message saying, get him out, shots fired, they closed the gate. I'm like, oh my God, I think I just got him killed.
Close calls with the Taliban happened again and again over the next month. Taliban militants found safe houses where Gholam and his family were hiding so he would flee or hide his documents in cracks in the ceiling. He'd message Mike and asked where could he go next. Mike would scramble to find a new safe house or a driver they could trust. Mike also had to get food to Gholam and his family and cash, and he was trying to do it all from Arizona. At one point, Gholam had to sell his wife's wedding ring. Finally, in mid-September, Mike and the Operation North Star team chartered a plane out of Afghanistan to Qatar. And Gholam and his family were on it.
I didn't believe it till Duke sent me the flight tracker that he left. And I just started crying because I'm like, I couldn't believe it. So many nights, sleepless nights. And I'm like, he's actually out of there. When it touched down, I'm like, okay, he's not going back. They're not turning the plane back.
We got off the airplane and it was a fresh air. I never had a fresh breath like that. I said, oh, finally you're in the United States.
I'm like, what would you think about coming to Arizona and you could be with me? And he's like, I think I would like that. So I'm like, okay, we'll make it happen.
Mike and his wife are now Gholam and his wife and children's family here in the United States. Gholam's other family members are still in Afghanistan. And because of his work as a former interpreter, he still fears for their safety due to ongoing reprisals from the Taliban. And that is why we are not using his full name. But life here in the U.S. isn't easy either. Mike had to help Gholam get a job, buy clothing, shoes, food, learn how to navigate the U.S. healthcare system.
Life in America itself is hard, but living with Mike is easy. I'm feeling I'm in my home, and there is not a single strange feeling that I'm living with Mike and his wife. They're right now my family. They're the best family I think I can ever have. And I feel very calm and free and very happy. And actually, we play sometimes with Mike and kids into the house. We bought some Nerf guns for kids. Yeah. And also there is an automatic Nerf gun which can hold 200 Nerf bullets. It's automatically, and it is really cool.
My wife took a picture of me that she saved as her profile picture of me on her phone, and it was just me with my hat on backwards shooting a Nerf gun, and she just said, this is my favorite picture of you because you look so happy. I've never seen you look this happy.
That's U.S. Air Force veteran Michael Tritt and former Air Force interpreter Gholam. Now, as you heard, Gholam was able to get out of Afghanistan with Michael's help through something called Operation North Star. It is not an official operation of the United States government. Instead, it is a group of U.S. veterans and others who have come together to do what they can privately to help Afghans they worked with get out of the country. And joining us now is another volunteer for Operation North Star, David Young. He's with us from Washington. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
So first of all, tell us what your experience in Afghanistan is, and because I want to understand how you got to the point where you've basically now devoted your life to helping some Afghans get out of country. But what took you there in the first place?
Sure. So for the last 15 years or so, my day job has centered around preventing and reducing violent conflict in various hotspots. And a lot of that time has been spent in or on Afghanistan. So just like you described with Mike and others, I made a lot of friends, a lot of close colleagues. These were interpreters, soldiers, civil servants, election officials, women's rights activists, you know, these people who took enormous risks for to serve the American cause in Afghanistan and to rebuild Afghanistan the way that we and many Afghans had envisioned. And so, when the government collapsed, these people were all panicked, just as you heard with Gollum.
Yeah. So let me just get some specifics here. I understand that for a couple of years, from 2010 to 2012, you were in Afghanistan serving as an advisor to the U.S. Army.
Yes, a civilian advisor along the border with Pakistan. Sort of as a trying to help the U.S. Army and the U.S. government build relationships and build institutions.
Right. So in order to, build those institutions, build up communities, assist with counterinsurgency efforts, things like that. So really critical things. And how essential were the Afghans who decided to work with the United States to, the efforts that you were directly part of during that time?
Absolutely critical. The entire premise wasn't to do it all on our own. The premise was to build up the country to a point where they could sustain everything on their own, where Afghans, Afghan officials, civil society actors could sustain it and carry it forward. So to say that we were doing things on our own would be, very inaccurate. We used every opportunity to support Afghans in a way that would make it last longer, make it sustainable.
Well, when we come back, we're going to hear a lot more about what is happening to those very Afghans, David, that you're talking about, and why you and others have come together in what's called Operation North Star to try to get them out of country. So hang on here for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about something called Operation North Star. It is not a formal operation out of the United States government. Instead, it is a group of American veterans, current and former members of the Defense Department, people who worked in or were deployed to Afghanistan during America's 20-year involvement there, who are now on their own trying to help get the Afghans who worked for them out of Afghanistan. I'm joined today by David Young. He's a volunteer with Operation North Star. So, David, can you tell me how did Operation North Star come together?
Sure. So, basically, the story that Mike described of that moment of panic, mm-hmm. the moment that I described of when the government collapsed, of trying to protect the people, the relationships that we had built over time, we were all individually trying to address this problem, knowing that we wouldn't be able to address it individually. So each of us fanned out like crazy trying to find other people like us so that we could close ranks, pull resources, and make sure that we could actually, lean on each other for fundraising, for trying to build the appropriate networks, policy connections, so that we could affect change and get people into safe houses. the premise was that there was this immediate need to make people say to make these people safe, and so we'd put them into safe houses. And there was this hope that we would sort of wait for the cavalry. You know, that was the short term plan, but really that cavalry just in any meaningful way really hasn't come, and so we've just resorted to trying to evacuate them ourselves.
And this was all last year. It happened relatively quickly.
Absolutely. It all came together in the early fall, shortly after the government collapsed in mid-August.
Okay. And so you were, I presume you were here in the United States, like Mike was when he described just that he was watching what was happening. And is that what sort of motivated this very quick coming together?
Yes. The 75 volunteers that currently comprise Operation North Star are all U.S.-based. We do this remotely, you know, from our kitchen tables, from our home offices.
Okay. I'm going to ask you in a second about how you actually do it here. But can you first tell me, you know, in that several-week period, now, those of us who never served or worked in Afghanistan were horrified by the images that we saw. But I imagine it meant something altogether more powerful for people like you, David. I mean, what were you thinking as you were watching the very rapid Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and as the U.S. withdrew?
There were really two competing crises, you know, sort of, you know, the emotional weight of having to deal with something that you spent years trying to build collapsing in front of your eyes and trying to process that. And then combined with that was the panic of knowing there are people who you care deeply about who are exceptionally vulnerable, not because they are now living in an awful Taliban wasteland, but instead because they are going to be and have already started to be hunted by them for their work and contributions to U.S. vision for Afghanistan and to the Afghan government.
The United States also made them a promise, didn't we?
Yes, certainly an implicit promise that we will stand with them. And in many cases, an explicit promise for those who have served and can demonstrably prove that they have served, you know, for either a year or more as an interpreter or as a contractor for the U.S. government.
Mm. Now, according to the Operation North Star website, the group says that it's made up of veterans, as we've talked about, plus current and former special operations personnel and current and former DOD officials as well, amongst others. So there are people in this group of 75 who are still in service, whether it's in the military or the Pentagon?
Yes. All of us are acting in an unofficial capacity. We are doing this in our personal capacity, nights and weekends. We are not leaning on government resources. It's through whatever resources we can muster and connections to try and get our people into safe houses to feed them and then eventually, hopefully, to evacuate them.
Does the Pentagon know about the work that the people who are still on duty or working at the DOD, does it know about what they're doing?
Sure.
Okay. And so I guess why I'm asking is because there has been criticism, as you well know, of the Biden administration, the State Department, the Pentagon, of not doing more to get the tens of thousands of Afghans out who still want to get out, who worked for the U.S. government. So the administration or military leadership doesn't see the work of Operation North Star in conflict with the work that people who are on active duty are still doing.
No. We work hard to create a real firewall between our official duties for those of us who are in government and what we're doing on the side. You know, it's the principle of the matter that it's like volunteering for any other organization. It's just something that we do on our own because we believe in it. It happens to have been related to our previous work experience, but we see that as quite incidental. There is a firewall that is important to us.
Okay. I guess what I'm getting at is I imagine that this is work that you would rather have the U.S. government be doing more successfully.
Yes, that is certainly the case. There's, you know— The frustration of seeing all of this unfold is a lot to carry for all of us, and it has become extremely important to us to try and to get these people out of the country. Seeing our government struggle with it has been difficult, but to be perfectly honest, at no point during the past 20 years was the U.S. government properly prepared for this war, not before the invasion, not for its execution, and certainly not for its withdrawal. And so it really would have been more surprising had the withdrawal gone well, given how poorly the entire war and rebuilding of the country went. Mm. But the U.S. government isn't doing nothing. They are, you know, the various agencies responsible for trying to resettle these vulnerable Afghans are doing what they can. It's just not enough. Mm. It's not even close to enough. You know, there are tens of thousands of applications that are going unread because there aren't enough people reviewing them. There are major bottlenecks up and down the chain, all the way from, you know, the application process all the way to the resettlement effort here in the United States. And we just need a great deal more resources being devoted to this within the government.
Right. You know, in fact, a little later in the show, we're going to hear from a diplomacy and national security reporter who's going to bring us more up to speed on exactly what you're talking about, David, about what's happening in terms of the official channels to try to get Afghans out of the country who wish to flee due to concerns about their lives and safety. But tell us a little bit more about how it actually works, how Operation North Star gets people out, because we got a little glimpse of it there with Mike and Hulam's story.
Sure.
How do you do it?
Sure. So there are three general flight paths out of the country that, you know, that are helpful to categorize and conceptualize how this is done. In Qatar, a country in the Middle East, we have the U.S. United States government has an airbase. And this is essentially, if you can get vulnerable Afghans to this airbase in Qatar, this is essentially the golden ticket, right? Once they're there, they are essentially on a glide path to eventually resettle in the United States. There is also a humanitarian city in the United Arab Emirates, another country in the Middle East. And in this humanitarian city, there are about 9,000 people who have been evacuated on charter aircraft to this location where the UAE government is hosting them. And this is, you know, this frankly, this has sort of become a little bit of a purgatory where people are safe from Taliban retaliation, which is fantastic. But it's also a bit of legal limbo because these people aren't super far along in their various application processes for eventual resettlement in the United States. And the third path is really the scrappiest option, which is bilateral negotiations that groups like ours implement with other countries to fly a plane full of extremely vulnerable Afghans to stay there, to park them there while their various applications can play out. And this is among the diciest because it is the most expensive and it's also politically tricky.
Mm. Well, that's essentially what Mike had to do to help his friend and former colleague get out. We had to simplify that part of the story, unfortunately. But he did go to Qatar, as you said, and then had to wait another period of time in a U.S. base before fully being allowed to come to this country. But so that's what happens at the point of departure from Afghanistan. The work that you're doing in Operation North Star doing begins well before that. I mean, I imagine that all of you know people who've already been, you know, detained or killed by the Taliban, because I understand it's happening every week there. So how do you get folks to safety even before there's any plan to actually get them out of the country?
Sure. So there are certain details of that I'm afraid I can't go into too much detail on. But what I can certainly say is that we have networks that we use so that when, for instance, you know, we call ourselves, each of the 75 volunteers, we call ourselves shepherds. Each of us have our respective flocks. So Hallam is part of Mike Tritt's flock. And so people who we take personal responsibility for, once those flocks we are in communication with, that they are extremely vulnerable, we work with these networks that we have developed to identify and facilitate safe houses. Then we have to feed them. We have to provide them with electricity and gas to basically sustain them. And this can cost approximately $500 a month for any given family of, say, 5 to 8. Then what we often need to do is to try and figure out, okay, we've got them safe. Now, they feel a somewhat a little bit of breathing room, but we know that that's certainly temporary. We can't, these funds aren't going to last forever. The meager funds that we've been able to collect from our generous donors. And so if they're not going to last forever, we have to develop a game plan for getting them out of the country. And doing that involves navigating this enormous bureaucracy of flight manifests. We have basically, I can't even tell you how much time we spend filling out Excel spreadsheets that have the demographic and biographical information of our flocks so that we can put them and lobby for them to be manifested on these various charter aircraft to going to those sort of three broad destinations I described earlier. We have to make sure that those people aren't – we have to work with the U.S. government and other organizations like ours work with the U.S. government to make sure that the people who we are trying to manifest on these flights aren't on the no-fly list, right? So we are not cowboying this. We are working within the system in which we are presented to make sure that our evacuation efforts are as successful as possible.
Yeah. So a couple of things to note there. You're exactly right that Operation North Star is one group. There are others doing similar work, right? I think I've read about Project Dynamo and others, also made up of similar people, veterans, members of the Pentagon, current and former. David, I hate to ask, but I must. Do you know people that you haven't been able to get out in time?
None of my flocks, okay. Members of my flocks have been killed. There have been a number of close calls. This past fall, I had two families in the same safe house, and the Taliban started banging on their door. And in a panic, the two dads, the two individuals who were the primary targets being hunted, had to flee out the back, leave their families behind to the sounds of the Taliban trying to break down the door and hide in an alleyway where they called me in a panic. I had to scramble to get them to a new safe house, and during which period, for 3 hours, they couldn't reach their families and had no idea what had happened to them or what has happened to them. And so those kinds of close calls, every single shepherd at Operation North Star, and I suspect at other organizations, has had close calls like that. But in many cases, it is substantially worse. Shepherds with our organization, collectively, we lose, on average, a few individuals to either permanent disappearance or murder every week. So it is a real threat against these people because as they wait for, you know, what I proverbially call the cavalry, they are being killed one by one.
It sounds like this has become your life.
It is quite the extracurricular activity, I can assure you of that.
Well, I read that you said that when their lives, meaning the people that you worked with in Afghanistan, when their lives were turned upside down, so was yours.
Yes, the joy and panic in our lives ebbs and flows with theirs, 100%.
Well, let's underscore the fact that not only is this a, quote, extracurricular activity, as you put it, David, but that the members of Operation North Star, just like other groups out there that are doing similar work, you're paying for this. On your own. I mean, so we talked to Duke, who, as you know, is another Operation North Star volunteer, and we're not going to share his full name because he intends to go to Afghanistan to assist in helping get people out, and he doesn't want to risk the Taliban knowing his identity. And here's what he told us about what it's taken to be part of Operation North Star.
The government isn't funding any of our organizations. All of our volunteers are volunteers. I left my nice, cushy corporate executive job where I was a marketing director, and I haven't been paid since August when I started doing this. And that's the case with many of our people across all of these organizations. We're trying to solve an Uncle Sam-sized problem with the personal checking accounts of veterans.
And he says some veterans have gone to extraordinary lengths in order to find the funds to do this work, taking out second mortgages on their homes, for example, to help support Afghans they're trying to protect.
You know, we tried to coach them and advise them not to do this, but their hearts are so big and they're so emotionally invested because these are their people that they've cleared out their bank accounts. I could point to a dozen people who all of their savings are gone trying to keep their people alive.
So this brings Duke back to a fundamental frustration he still has, and that this work has to be done, in his view, by veterans like that make up groups like Operation North Star because of how the United States handled evacuation efforts this past summer.
This is what a government is for. I mean, our entire veteran community should not have to step up and empty their bank accounts to go and save people's lives who we promised that this wouldn't happen to. The government should not let that happen.
David Young, just want to give you a quick chance to respond to what Duke said. Do you feel like there's any progress being made in terms of the State Department right now in working harder to get Afghans out?
It really has to be noted that they are making an effort. Every hole that we have identified and that others have identified is being plugged. It's just not even close to enough.
Mm. Well, we'll hear from a reporter in Washington who covers diplomacy and national security with more details on that. So, David, stand by here for just a minute. We're talking this hour about Operation North Star, and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be taking a look once again at the concept of vaccine passports. We covered this about a year ago when they were first popping up in different places around the world, specifically Israel. Well, now Israel might actually relax its vaccine passport program. Other countries are strengthening them. Several American cities, in fact, are instituting vaccine passport programs. So we want to hear from you. Do you support the idea? Do you not support the idea? Do you think vaccine passports work? What are they trying to achieve? What has your experience been like in your city or town if it has a vaccine passport program to get into a bar, a restaurant, a gym, a museum for adults and for kids? So we really want to hear all sorts of experiences and points of view when it comes to the requirement for vaccination to go out to eat or check out a movie or a museum. So tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow. Today, we're learning about a program called Operation North Star. It's actually not an official operation of the United States government. Instead, it's a group of more than 70 U.S. veterans, current and former members of the Pentagon, lawyers and other civilians who have worked in Afghanistan, who came together last year to help evacuate Afghans who worked for the United States over the past 20 years and cannot get out of the country. David Young joins us. He's a volunteer with Operation North Star. And David, if you hang on here with me for another few minutes, I'd like to turn to Missy Ryan, who covers diplomacy and national security for The Washington Post. Missy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Meghna.
So first of all, let's acknowledge that even in the chaos of the U.S. withdrawal last year, I'm seeing that some 100,000 Afghans were evacuated by the United States and U.S. allies at that time. But that number of official evacuations, how much has it slowed down by?
Yeah, well, there was this fire hose of departures during the 2 weeks that preceded the American final departure at the end of August of 2021. And that really has become a painfully slow drip since September. And we've seen, as David said, this patchwork of private groups step in and attempt to bring out vulnerable Afghans or Afghans who work with the United States or Afghans who might be targeted by the Taliban because of their identity, or their work. But, you know, as he said, it's really a small slice of the massive population of Afghans who want to get out, who are trying to explore different avenues for getting to either the West or the United States or just anywhere other than Afghanistan.
Do we know how many Afghans are still desperate to get out?
No, we don't. So 80,000 Afghans have made it to the United States so far, and about three quarters of those have already been resettled via these resettlement agencies that the U.S. government works with in communities across America. There's a small minority that are still on military bases in the United States waiting to be resettled. And then there's a smaller population of Afghans who are waiting in waiting in third countries like the UAE and Qatar, and then countries including Albania or Kosovo or Mexico or Uganda to get approval from the United States to come. And those at this point really are in difficult conditions. It can take 1 or 2 years for their immigration and refugee applications to go through. So, and then there's this larger population that the U.S. government can't even really put a number on of people inside Afghanistan, you know, women's activists, female judges, religious minorities, members of the LGBTQ community who could be singled out by the Taliban. And they just don't even have either the financial resources or the logistical ability to get out.
So you heard David a little earlier talk about the fact that there just aren't enough people. That's part of the problem. Working on the bureaucratic maze that folks have to go through in order to get out of Afghanistan and resettled into the United States. Does the State Department have any response to that?
You know, the Biden administration has said repeatedly that they are working to help at-risk Afghans. But as time has gone on, it's become more clear that the population of Afghans who they're working with most actively, or critics would say working with at all, are American citizens who remained in Afghanistan after the fall of the U.S.-affiliated government, green card holders, and then a very small slice of the special immigrant visa applicants who are the people who work directly with the U.S. military or with the U.S. embassy in Afghanistan. And so, you know, there is sort of a conflict between how the Biden administration is talking about what it's doing in Afghanistan and what the reality on the ground is in terms of people who say that, you know, we're at risk too. Can you please help us? But I think there's a little bit of context that I would like to mention here, which is that, you know, I think it's important to recall that the Biden administration does not have diplomatic relations with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. We do not have an embassy there, and we've only had limited interactions with the Taliban. And the Biden administration is really sensitive to criticism that it is supporting the Taliban government in any way or working with terrorists. And so there's a fine diplomatic line that they will talk about and that they're trying to strike. But, you know, as individuals like David and the others who are working with private groups will say, you know, that doesn't address at all the vulnerability of the Afghans who remain in Afghanistan right now.
So that's really important context here. And David, first, let me turn to you and just get your response. I mean, how much is that political reality coupled with the, you know, the lack of diplomatic ties, as Missy was talking about, hampering even, you know, private efforts like Operation North Star.
When you look at the practicalities of what it takes to go through one of these application processes, it requires interviews with U.S. officials to determine, for instance, that they do not pose a terrorist threat to the United States. This is a really important part of the vetting process for all of these different pathways. And to get an interview, you have to sit with an official. We don't have any officials in Afghanistan. So you have to leave the country in order first for your applications, for many of these applications, to actually get started. And that presents problems to where, you know, we have to weigh these really, really tricky pros and cons. Let's say we can get a member of our flock out of the country. We have to then sustain them in that other country until that application can actually proceed and make progress, make way. And then there's still no guarantee that they would even be accepted, which would mean that it's quite a gamble for these to say to one of our flocks, yes, your life is in danger. We can protect you if we get you out of the country. But once you're out of the country, you may end up having to go back to Afghanistan in a year or two if your application fails to make any headway. And so that relationship or lack of relationship with the Taliban poses a significant problem for our ability to evacuate people in large numbers if the Biden administration wanted to. If that were a policy decision, it's difficult in practice on top of that.
Mm. Now, I should note that we reached out to the State Department to see if anyone could join us from state. That didn't happen, but we did send them a detailed list of questions, and they responded to them. And I just want to read a few of their responses and get your impression, Missy, and yours as well, David. So first of all, I mean, we just asked them the basic question of what sort of efforts are currently underway at state to continue helping the evacuation of Afghans who wish to leave the country. And they said, Missy, per your reporting as well, the State Department official told us that the current focus is on supporting departures of U.S. citizens, lawful permanent residents, and their immediate families, some of whom may already hold legal immigrant status. And they said, as we have said before, we will be relentless in this effort as we stand by our Afghan allies and their families. So, Missy, though, let me turn back to you. Do you know from sources or things that you've heard State Department officials say about is there internal frustration at the State Department that they can't at this point in time do more to get what may be tens of thousands of people out of Afghanistan?
Absolutely. There is frustration across the government, you know, as you and David were discussing earlier, there are people actively serving in the Biden administration who have taken part in their spare time in these volunteer evacuation and resettlement efforts. And I think that's a real important indication of how strongly people feel about this. I remember, you know, going back to mid-August, receiving messages from people within the government saying, can you help? You know, we're trying to get so-and-so person on a flight. And And there were diplomats across the world who took part in this all hands on deck effort to try to process the departure list during those critical 2 weeks in August of 2021 in the embassy in Mexico City, in the embassy in New Delhi. And so, you know, I think that's an indication of how invested people, not just in the military, but also in the Foreign Service, were in the plight of these Afghans. And so I think what you're seeing is some tension between the policy decisions that are made at the top, which is that, you know, there's only so much we can do given the diplomatic constraints, the logistical constraints and all of that, and the feelings of a lot of people who either served in Afghanistan themselves or just, you know, identified with the links that the United States has with Afghans based on our two decades in the country.
Mm. Well, the State Department also told us in response to the question of how many people do they estimate are still in Afghanistan who are high risk and want to get out. And they told us that quote, "We cannot offer an exact number of SIVs, or special immigrant visas, in Afghanistan. Some have already departed, independent of state's assistance. Some were evacuated and are in the United States, and some have not responded to attempts to contact them. But as the secretary has said, according to this State Department official, there is no deadline on this effort." Now, David, we also asked them about what the State Department how it views groups like Operation North Star. They sent us quite a significant response to that question. And I'll just read you one portion of it. They say that there are two important elements to relocating groups and individuals via privately organized operations. And you've actually gone over these, David, arranging the departure and safe passage out of Afghanistan, as well as what happens to the families when they permanently resettle. And then the State Department official told us there have been significant challenges with some of these privately organized efforts. Without U.S. government personnel on the ground to ensure the fidelity of the intended manifests on those flights out, there's no ability to determine whether the passengers aboard the plane would be eligible for relocation or resettlement in the United States. Can you respond to that, David?
Sure. So the State Department's overriding principle, and it has some merit in terms of their philosophy for their approach to evacuations, is we don't want people to leave Afghanistan unless they are extremely likely to be able to be resettled eventually, to people who will have a final destination. And this makes sense from a position of efficiency, and that there is a but there's really also this political element to it. Let me give you an example. If we were to transport, as has happened in the past, a plane full of people to Albania, as Missy described, right? And then eventually, if let's say there's 300 people on that flight, they land, we pay for their support when they land in order for their applications to proceed, and then it turns out that half of them are not eligible. Well, then the State Department has a political problem on its hands. It is unable to, it would look quite bad. And these are things that the State Department has to worry about that we do not. And we're very happy that we don't have to worry about that. But from their perspective, if you've got 150 people who are not resettleable somewhere, then you basically have, to put it bluntly, you've got Tom Hanks stuck in an airport for 150 people, and then it can become a diplomatic problem with that host country. And so the State Department has to think about these things in ways that we do not. We think that is certainly worth the risk, because these people who we intend and have been and are trying to evacuate are dying one by one. And so we think that risk is worthwhile, and it makes perfect sense that the State Department has this other approach. We think ours is better, obviously.
Mm. Now, Missy, of course, there are a lot of people listening who are probably thinking, well, none of this needed to happen if the evacuation and the U.S. withdrawal last year had been better handled. But, I mean, looking forward, though, there could be tens of thousands of people still in Afghanistan who are desperate to get out. I'm wondering, though, it sounds like the purgatory they're in, there isn't any fix for it at the moment, given the diplomatic and political and then practical considerations that you've outlined. Could there be any change on the horizon?
I don't anticipate any major change, and Biden administration officials, senior officials, will privately acknowledge that this is an incredibly unsatisfactory outcome, but there is no political support in the Biden administration for a radical change. You know, one of the reasons why President Biden decided to undertake the withdrawal in the way that he did was that the administration felt like it needed to prioritize other national security priorities, and including China and including power competition with Russia. And so, I think that they will take some of these smaller efforts and certainly try to prioritize people with the deepest links to the United States. But I don't anticipate, certainly at this time, any sort of large-scale change that would help these Afghans with only peripheral ties to the United States.
Missy Ryan at The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Young, we've got 15 seconds. How much longer do you think you and the members of Operation North Star are going to continue to try and get people out?
As long as it takes. this will not be something that we give up on anytime soon, and we need all the help that we can get.
Well, that's David Young, a volunteer with Operation North Star. David, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. Great to be here.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.